The statistical tendency that I've been writing about since 1987, which I have sometimes called interpretive rule one or heuristic rule X, and which researchers in the United Kingdom recently referred to as Scanlon's rule, and I've been happy enough to adopt that. The pattern is inherent in the shapes of normal risk distributions and may be stated as follows. When two groups differ in their susceptibility to an outcome, the rarer the outcome, the greater tends to be the relative difference in experiencing it, and the smaller tends to be the relative difference in avoiding it. Among implications of this pattern is, as mortality declines, relative differences in mortality rates tend to increase, while relative differences in survival rates tend to decrease. As rates of appropriate health care increase, relative differences in receipt of appropriate care tend to decrease, while relative differences in rates of failing to receive appropriate care tend to increase. Lowering blood pressure generally will tend to increase relative differences in hypertension, while decreasing relative differences in rates of avoiding hypertension. Improving overall folate levels will tend to increase relative differences in low folate, while reducing relative differences in adequate folate. Among relatively advanced subpopulations, college-educated, high SES, the young, the insured, relative differences in adverse outcomes tend to be large, since they are rarer among those populations, while relative differences in favorable outcomes tend to be smaller in those subpopulations, and so on. But there are broader issues that, see, all standard measures of differences between outcome rates tend to be affected by the overall prevalence of an outcome for reasons, again, related to the shapes of the underlying distributions. That the failure to recognize these patterns has led to disarray and futility in health and healthcare disparities research, particularly with regard to efforts to measure changes over time and efforts otherwise to compare the size of disparities in different settings. But there's the same disarray and futility in every other area in the law and the medical, social and medical sciences, where differences between outcome rates are a matter of consequence. Because I don't expect people to be fully persuaded or necessarily to understand everything I say here, I like to give a list of references, and all of these, my presentation will be posted on my website, jpscanlon.com, under the presentation section of the Measuring Health Disparities page. And these links will be available on in the presentation as posted there. And here are several articles and a couple of AFA presentations addressing this same issue. This references too is our pages on that website. The Measuring Health Disparities page has about 130 references discussing these patterns in particular contexts in the law and the social and medical sciences. The Scanlon's Rule page discusses the nuances of the patterns. The Mortality and Survival page discusses the way that, especially in cancer journals, researchers discuss disparities in mortality and disparities in survival interchangeably without recognizing, for example, that as overall survival improves, relative differences in survival rates will tend to decrease, while relative differences in mortality rates tend to increase. The measures of association is simply to remind everyone, including myself, that what I talk about here in terms of disparities is really simply about association. This is a list of approaches to disparities measurement, common approaches. And many researchers, perhaps the majority, rely on relative differences in adverse outcomes with regard to things like morbidity and mortality, while relying on relative differences in favorable outcomes with regard to things like health care. But the National Center for Health Statistics, since about 2005, always relies on relative differences in adverse outcomes. That is, for example, it will measure disparities in terms of differences in failure to be immunized rather than differences in immunization rates. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality will rely on whichever of the two relative differences is the larger. The Health Policy Group of Harvard Medical School usually, but not always, tends to rely on absolute differences. When I titled my presentation about the research in the U.S., I was overlooking that really the leading commentators on health disparities measurement issues over here are from Canada, or Sam Harper and John Lynch, Lynch actually being from Australia. And they have written a lot lately about relative and absolute differences, emphasizing that both are telling a particular truth, even when the measures yield different conclusions as to directions of changes over time. And they have lately argued that value judgments are involved in choosing a disparities measures, as in this recent Milbank Fund publication. That view, however, fails to recognize that there is in fact an underlying reality, and only one underlying reality as to whether disparity is changing, is increasing or decreasing. If that does not become clear in this presentation, please see the more specific treatment on the relative versus absolute subpage of the Measuring Health Disparities page. I'm going to illustrate these patterns that I've roughly described just now with some data. The patterns can really be demonstrated with any data set that allows one to examine various points on the continuum of factors associated with experiencing or failing to experience an outcome. Income data is quite useful in this regard, but NHANES provides a wide range of data where one can illustrate the same patterns. I prefer, however, to use hypothetical data for purposes of illustration. This figure is based on a situation of two normal test score distributions where the advantage group has a mean score half a standard deviation above the mean score of the disadvantaged group, AG and DG. The numbers along the bottom line are failure rates, which are used as benchmarks for overall prevalence. And as we move from left to right, we observe the effects on the ratio of lowering cutoffs, such as to serially enable the population between each point to pass the test at the next higher point. And we observe as the cutoffs are lowered and test failure becomes less common, the ratio of AG's failure rate to DG's failure rate increases. The next figure adds the opposite side of the picture, the relative difference in pass rates, here presented in terms of the ratio of AG's pass rate to DG's pass rate. And as cutoffs are lowered, the relative difference in pass rates decreases. Thus, do we observe the way that relative differences in experiencing an outcome and relative differences in avoiding an outcome tend to change systematically in opposite directions as the overall prevalence of an outcome changes. Figure 3 addresses the absolute difference between rates, which also changes systematically as overall prevalence changes, though in a more complicated way. When a widespread outcome, more than 50% for both groups, declines, absolute differences tend to increase. When an uncommon outcome, less than 50% for both groups, decreases, absolute differences tend to decline. When the rate is more than 50% for one group and less than 50% for the other, between points A and B in the figure, patterns of absolute differences are somewhat harder to predict. The nuances of these patterns are explained on the Scanlon's Rule page, but the details are not especially important. Figure 4 presents the odds ratio, which tends to change in the opposite direction of the absolute difference. And figure 5 presents all of these patterns together. I'm spending very little time on this because I've covered it in many places, including the two alpha presentations. Here, however, it is merely background. I add an interesting thing, however, and that's that AHRQ funds a great deal of health care disparities research. And researchers are increasingly using absolute differences to measure those disparities, whereas AHRQ itself relies on the larger of the two relevant differences. And though it's probably not obvious right there, but absolute differences tend to change in the same direction as the smaller of the two relative differences. Thus, AHRQ-funded research is commonly tends to systematically find patterns that are the opposite of the way that AHRQ would interpret the data. This is a table based on an award-winning study that appeared in Pediatrics in 2008. The authors examined the effects of a school entry hepatitis B vaccination requirement on race-ethnic differences in vaccination rates. Relying on relative differences in vaccination rates as a measure of disparities, the authors found the disparities to have dramatically decreased, both for the fifth and ninth grades, as reflected in the favorable ratio column that I'm unable to figure out how to highlight here. But the next column, the adverse ratio column, shows that NCHS, which would rely on relative differences in failure to be vaccinated, would find substantial increases in disparities. Other approaches would yield different results for different time periods. The final column shows the size of the disparity according to what I maintain is the only appropriate measure of disparity. That is an approach that is not affected by the changes in the overall prevalence of an outcome. It is the subject of my 2008 AFA presentation and one addressed on the solutions subpage of the Measuring Health Disparities page. But the details of that approach are outside the scope of this presentation. I will merely point out that it involves deriving from any pair of rates the difference between the means of the underlying hypothetical distributions. It's a procedure I developed mechanically in early 2008, but in 2010 came first to recognize that it has been around since 1934, and it is what is known as the Probit analysis. Table 2 provides an illustration akin to that in Table 1. Here at issue are uncommon procedures that are increasing in overall prevalence, three different procedures. Consistent with theory, relative differences in receipt of the procedures decrease, while relative differences in failing to receive them increase. Absolute differences increase, which is what typically happens when rates are in this range, that is, when rare outcomes are becoming more common. Again, the final column shows what provides the best indicator of what I think is the true picture of whether the healthcare disparities are increasing or decreasing. I have a great many more illustrations of this same nature in a number of recent presentations, especially a 2008 presentation in Helsinki that's also on the website. The next slide brings us back to the title of this presentation, the emerging European recognition that standard measures of differences tend to be affected by the overall prevalence of an outcome, and the need to take overall prevalence into account in appraising health disparities. But while there's a good deal more discussion of these issues in Europe than on this side of the Atlantic, Europe too has a long way to go. Only the first of these items, Carr-Hill and Chalmers-Dixon, recognizes theoretical basis for the observed patterns. And most of the other authors, though recognizing patterns that all call all prior methods into question, have then gone on to do further research using those same prior methods. In any case, section E7 of Measuring Health Disparities summarizes the degree of consensus with my thinking both here and abroad, discussing your colleague David McCannick in doing so. It also points out that I think both NCHS and HHRQ have done a real disservice to health disparities research in the U.S. by failing to straightforwardly address these issues. My final slide lists some further readings. These are subpages of pages I previously referenced. These address particular issues where standard practices are unsound for failure to recognize the way that various measures of differences are affected by the overall prevalence of an outcome. And if you're going to study health disparities or study anything about measures of association, I suggest that you will find it useful to read these pages, even if you should not agree with them or disagree with them in substantial respects. Keep in mind, as you think about this, it is not important that one commonly observes departures from the distributionally driven patterns I have described. Such patterns that I've described here are merely part of the picture, but one must understand that part of the picture to interpret the overall picture. And nor does it matter that the underlying distributions may not always be normal or close to normal. Such facts merely complicate efforts to appraise the size of disparities while taking overall prevalence into account. They do not provide a basis for relying on standard measures while ignoring that those measures are systematically affected by changes in overall prevalence that have nothing to do with meaningful changes in disparities. Our interest is in finding the changes that are other than those that are driven by overall changes in prevalence. Thank you.
Question? You have 7 minutes. Good.
Yes?
Are there methods to correct for this, either in the study design or, you know, in the traditional?
I didn't quite hear you. Could you say that again, please? I think the method that I mentioned earlier, that's described on the solutions page of the Measuring Health Disparities, it's not exactly a method of correcting. It's rather a different approach, and it involves deriving from a pair of rates the difference between the means of the underlying distributions measured in terms of standard deviations. And it is, you can find it, I mean, I have an elaborate database online to implement it, which is sort of a mechanical database that I made sort of like a slide rule. But as I said, I came to understand that it exists in the probit analysis, and there are many online calculators of the probit.
Assuming normality in both cases, the underlying distribution.
Yes, and of course, whether it's normal is an important issue. I think, however, that approaching it from the normality gives you the baseline
right for
understanding. And it also shows you that these standard, even when the data is normal, or are normal, these standard measures are problematic. And they're, I'll say, a fortiori problematic when there are also issues as to the
like you're talking about the absolute difference and relative. I mean, you're in favor to absolute difference?
No, not at all.
Relative.
Although I do see, I don't want to overlook the fact that in things like in standard epidemiology, what is really important with regard to whether a pill increases your survival. And I concur with the many people who think the absolute difference is what is important there. And but as far as measuring whether a disparity is changing or not, neither the relative nor the absolute difference is providing enough information, because each is influenced by the change in overall prevalence.
Okay, another question? Thank you very much.
Thank you.